And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. David Darling, British astronomer, regular here on Coast to Coast AM, PhD from the University of Manchester in England. He's the author of a number of books on subjects ranging from life in the universe to life after death. And he's got a great one now. The latest, We Are Not Alone, Why We Already Found Extraterrestrial Life. And by the way, his website, The Words of David Darling, tackles everything from silicon-based life to UFOs, and here he is back on Coast to Coast. David, my friend, how are you?
I'm very well, George. How are you doing?
Good to have you back with us. How are things going in the UK these days?
Oh, they're ticking along, wow. Yep. Watching events over the pond too. It's interesting.
I'm telling you.
Interesting times.
Many times, David. Many, and at least thank God for science, huh?
Well, at least you know where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a long time ago, I was talking about this book that my mother had given me by
Sure.
Walter Sullivan called We Are Not Alone.
Absolutely.
And you've taken it a step farther. In those days, Walter, as a science writer, didn't have the kind of information that we're getting today. It's remarkable what could be out there, David, isn't it?
Well, you know, we consciously borrowed Walter's title because, as you mentioned in your introduction there, it was a hugely influential book and it affected me. And got me going into science, and of course he was talking about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which had just begun back in the 60s. I think his book came out in about 66, so I would have been in my early teens then, and the most influential age, you know. And it just, it was a visionary book, I mean, well ahead of its time. But the science of astrobiology, the actual search for life on other planets, was really in its infancy in those days. And he was talking about even going beyond that, you know, looking for signals from worlds going around other stars, which we're still doing, of course. But we've borrowed that title and we stuck on the subtitle, Why We Have Already Found Extraterrestrial Life. And our claim, and I should say, when I say we, because this is the first book I've actually co-authored, and it's co-authored with an astrobiologist, an active professional scientist at Washington State University called Dirk Schulz-Makuch, who I'm good friends with. But he is a young and up-and-coming astrobiologist. He's written many papers on life on Mars and Venus and Titan. It's good to have him on board because he kind of puts the scientific stamp of approval on a book that I believe every word of, but it's nice to have an active scientist with me as a co-author. But we're cutting through all the nonsense, and we're saying we have already found proof of extraterrestrial life based on the Viking mission, which is now 34 years old, and other information that's come since from Mars meteorites and methane discoveries on Mars, and we think that we've got conclusive proof of that, and that's the case that we're making in our new book.
You know what's amazing? As you said, the Viking. At 36 years, can you believe that, Dave?
I know. It's just incredible, isn't it? It seems like yesterday, just like the Apollo missions do. You know, they're so alive in your memory.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a generation or more ago. It is incredible. But the thing about the Viking is that we found life through Viking. And in a sense, and I kind of believe, it may be a strong way to put it, but I think the public was actually misled about the results that came from Viking. The scientific mainstream from that was that Viking didn't find life. That the things that it did find, you could put down to active chemicals in the soil. But when you go through those results, and also you look at that findings that have come to light since about faulty instrumentation on which that scientific claim was made, you realize that actually the signals that Viking did pick up pointed very, very, very strongly to organisms in the Martian soil. And that's a key point that we make in the book.
That's exciting. And, you know, with this universe as vast as it is, and we'll talk about that later on, David, there have got to be hundreds and thousands of Earth-like planets out there, don't you think? Just by probability.
Yeah. We're already finding them. We because we've got this new Kepler space probe, which is now specifically looking for Earth-like planets around other stars. And as our instruments get more sensitive and our techniques get more sophisticated, we are discovering smaller and smaller, in other words, more Earth-like, rocky-type planets around other stars. We already know about 500 now planets going around other stars. It's absolutely staggering. That's within just just about the last decade or so, we've discovered 500 planets, and the rate of discovery is increasing all the time. So within another decade, I am sure we'll have a catalogue of hundreds, if not thousands, of Earth-like planets, and then we can start to look at those promising worlds for signs of life, and that's when the whole field is going to blow wide open.
What do you think of this, what I call, David, the primordial soup in the universe, where everything does seem to be the same? The elements generally are the same on all the planets.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just all there, and it just seems to have so much order to it. Solar systems are the same. They all create themselves the same. The stars, you know, do their thing. Why is it so orderly?
Well, this gets to maybe this is something we can come back to later on as well, but this is a key question now that the scientists as well as ordinary folk are starting to wonder about is also why is the universe so creative? You know, you go back you go back 13, 14 billion years ago to the supposed Big Bang when everything was chaotic, and you know, you've got this massive explosion, and you've got just got energy and matter, and it would just look like a bomb going off, basically, you know, in a simple-minded way. And yet 14 billion years later, it's organized itself into galaxies and stars and planets and dogs and human beings and all the rest of it that we see. You look around you, and you would never, ever, if you had been a fly on the wall in those days, could you imagine that it would have resulted in this? Now, whatever interpretation you put on that, there's some sort of information or code built into the universe. Whatever you want to believe is behind that.
Yes. You want to say intelligence, I know it.
you want to say there's some guiding principle that, you know, there is no way that if you set off a bomb that 14 billion years later it's going to organize itself into what we've got around us today. You know, that there is something innate in the universe that directs it towards creativity. I agree with you. I don't know myself what's behind that. You can call it what you want, but you know, the fact is it's incredible what has happened. Some scientists say, they say, well, okay, there's more than one universe, okay?
Exactly.
There's not two, there's not three, there's almost an infinite number. There's trillions and trillions and trillions of universes, and in those that don't produce order and complexity in life, there's nobody around to ask the question. But in the ones that where life appears, people start wondering, hey, something funny is going on here, you know. So you can go that route as well. But, you know, it's a huge question at the moment.
You know, I'm in the Midwest right now, and I was driving today by a golf course, and I saw people out there, you know, golfing away. I used to golf years ago when I was younger, but it takes up so much time. I don't have that kind of time anymore. But they're out there. They're having a great time. And as I'm driving past these people, David, I'm saying to myself, the old question, what's it all about? Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I started thinking about people who were cave dwellers, and you know, back thousands and thousands of years. And they didn't have golf courses. They didn't do this. They didn't have television. They didn't have computers. Their day-to-day existence was waking up, going to eat, going to get food, and procreating, coming back home, and that was it. That was their life.
Mm-hmm.
And as I thought about what it would be like to be a cave dweller, at any point did they say to themselves, what am I here for? And you know, and if they had any kind of intelligence at all, don't you think they would have asked themselves that question, even at that primitive stage?
I think they would. You know, and the thing is that, you know, even if you're talking about tens of thousands of years ago, you know, and those people are just as smart as we were. You know, you go back.
Oh yeah.
You go back 40,000, even 100,000 years ago. Those creatures that you know that we still call them human. They had the same brain capacity. You raise one of their children in a school today, and they would turn out just perfectly normal. You know, they would look like the rest of us. You know, so they had that capability, and they would, you know, they would gather at the mouth of their caves at night, and they'd look up at the stars. They weren't stupid. You know, they didn't know what they were looking at, but they would look at those points of light in the sky, and they would wonder about it. You know, I'm reminded of the film 2001, A Space Odyssey, a scientific classic, where, you know, where those, and that's going back even further in time because they were then, you know, ape men rather more than human. But they wondered about things. They were curious. They would ask questions. And there's no doubt about that. There's no doubt about that. They would interpret things in a different way than we do today, obviously, based on what they knew. But they would wonder. They were curious. That's the innate human drive is to wonder, to explore, to ask, what on earth is it all about? You know, that's who we are.
Can you imagine how far we've come in the last 100 and 150 years?
I know.
Dramatic.
I know. You know, flight. When did that start? 1908. I'm not very good at my history,
right,
but you know, the Wright brothers. 1908. That's just over 100 years ago. I think we celebrated the centennial of that a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And now we've got probes heading out of the solar system. We've got five spacecraft now that are bound on courses that will lead them to the stars. 100 years after we first, you know, had powered flight. That is spectacular.
40 years ago, we were on the moon. That was 24 years after World War II. Whoever would have imagined that?
Exactly. You know, and we are capable of so much more. You know, we get, you know, you get finances and politics and all the rest of it get in the way, but we have the capability to go to the stars, to explore the universe as a whole. And our minds somehow seem to be tuned into that. You know, as going back to what we were saying before, you know, these cave people that lived thousands of years ago, you raise one of their kids in a regular school today, they'd be capable of math, they'd be capable of going on to do physics and relativity and all the rest of it, you know?
That's true.
Why is it that our brains are so capable of such a thing? Why do you need to be able to do calculus and relativity and quantum mechanics if you're just bent on survival? Why is it our brains are already keyed into that kind of thing? That's a question that fascinates me.
I wonder if the cave baby, though, would eat the pet dog or something in a school.
Well, it would be tempting, wouldn't it? Yeah,
it would be. But you're right. I, it's if you put them in this environment,
they would
be able to possess the things we can teach
they'd
them.
They'd be the same as us. Exactly. That's right. And which is incredible. Why is that? You know, why are our brains so attuned to the universe as a whole? Well, we came from the universe, really. You know, I mean, every atom of our being is made from stuff that has been recycle through stars. That's the only way that elements like carbon, which are the basis of life, is created.
It's all over the place, David. Hey, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back. This show's going faster than a rocket ship. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with astronomer David Darling with us. We're talking about his latest work, We Are Not Alone. David, what's going on in the world of astronomy? New techniques, new equipment, making things even more marvelous.
Yeah, both on the ground and in space, we're rolling right along with instruments that can take us further back into the universe. Because of course, the further we look back in space, the further we look back in time. So we're seeing things close to the beginning of everything, and at the same time, we're looking for, as we've already talked about, new planets around other stars, a huge amount of information coming in. It's almost too much information to process, really. That's the problem right now, is we're being overwhelmed by the amount of new information that's coming in. And these giant telescopes that are being in the process of being built, that are going to extend our vision even more, these are very, very exciting times.
Scientists last week reported that deep under Antarctica, they spotted other species of fish. Mm. They had no idea what these creatures could have been. They didn't think they existed. Mm. That tells me that some of these planets that might not be as close to their sun as we are to ours, maybe there is some other life there too.
We've got to be imaginative and extend our net further because, of course, we only know about one example of life, you know, the familiar life that we see around us. But even so, we're becoming aware of creatures that can exist in extreme environments, you know, these hot hydrothermal vents at the bottom of oceans where it's completely dark and the only energy available is chemical energy coming from the stuff that's pouring out of these cracks in the seabed. And, you know, and we're also finding places further out in the solar system, like these moons of Jupiter and Saturn, which are appear to be frozen. You know, years ago, nobody would have given a second glance. They would have looked, said, well, these are just cold balls of rock. Now we're discovering that they might have underground oceans heated by tidal heating, gravitational heating, which could well have life in them. You know, wherever you've got a lot of water and you've got a source of energy, you've got to think, well, there could be life in them. So we have to be more creative in our thinking. Life isn't just going to be like the sort of familiar things we see around us. There could be even more examples on familiar life right here on our own planet, let alone way out in space. So life could take many forms, both simple and advanced. Yeah,
absolutely. What's your take on Phobos? Mars is one of its moons, where astronomers weren't quite so sure what that thing was.
Yeah. You know, way back, and this is going back again to the Walter Sullivan era, back in the 60s. There was some discussion about the moons of Mars being artificial because they're unusual in the way they move. They're very, very close to Mars, for one thing. They're the closest moons to a planet that we know of. They're just a few thousand or tens of thousands of miles up. You know, they're just little balls of rocks. There's two of them, Phobos and Deimos. One's about 5 or so miles across. The other's about 10, 15 miles across. They're little chunks of rock, probably captured asteroids, but you see them close up, and they've got some unusual features on them. Phobos, for instance, has got some strange grooves running across its surface and a giant crater. They're interesting objects. We don't know a whole lot about them, but they're quite unlike our own moon when you look at them visually.
Would you be in shock if we found out that it was artificial, at least one of them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Everybody would be in shock. You know, you hear talk about this and speculation about, and I'm quite open to some of these things. I'm not sure.
You are.
Not sure about Phobos and Deimos. To me, they look like asteroids when you look at them. But, you know, talk about artificial structures on Mars, for example. Now, I can build a scientific picture for you that leads from, as I was talking about before, our book begins with virtual proof that Viking and subsequent information has found simple life forms on Mars, okay?
Yeah.
Now, you can start from that, and you can build a picture of how advanced life could come about on Mars. Now, I'm not going to carry everybody through with that argument, maybe not a lot of mainstream scientists, but you can certainly make a case that if life got started on Mars, as I firmly believe it did, and it still exists there today, that Mars may well have developed complex life, in other words, something equivalent to our animals and plants, very, very early on. Now, it happened late on Earth. It took a long time to go from, say, bacteria to, you know, kangaroos and human beings on Earth. It took billions of years. And part of the reason for that is you need an oxygen-rich atmosphere for the kind of advanced life we have here on Earth. Now, the reason that we didn't get oxygen early on Earth is because of plate tectonics. You get this recycling of oxygen, which takes it away from the atmosphere and buries it back into the rocks again. Now, on Mars, there isn't such a recycling process. There is no plate tectonics, no movement of the crust. So any oxygen that was produced early on could have remained in the atmosphere. Now, if you had an early oxygen-rich atmosphere on Mars, say within 100 million years of the first life appearing, it could have accelerated the process to advanced and complex life very early on, hundreds of times faster than it did on Earth. So there is a reason to believe that maybe complex life developed on Mars long, long time ago, maybe 3.5 billion years ago. What happened to it subsequently, we don't know. But, you know, people look at features on Mars and they say, hey, that looks like a face, that looks like pyramids,
yeah,
you know, things right. like that, you know, and on the surface they say, oh, that looks a little bit like a skull. Some of these things I don't buy at all, you know. If I see something that looks like a skull, I think, ah, that's just a rock that looks like a skull. It's not necessarily a skull. You don't jump right to that conclusion. But you've got to look at some of these things and you think, boy, those do look like a group of pyramids, you know.
Well, maybe what Yeah, when you look at it in its entirety, David, then you have to come up with some of those conclusions.
You've got to consider them and not dismiss them out of hand, as many scientists do. Because, you know, just because something doesn't fit within your comfortable worldview doesn't mean that it's not worth looking at, you know. So So people, and as I said before, there's so much information coming in, so many pictures from space probes. And we've got a whole slew of spacecraft either on the surface or going around Mars that are sending back millions, literally millions of images. There's no way that conventional scientists can look through every detail of these and look for, you know, interesting anomalies. But, you know, folk at home who, you know, pull up these raw images, they can do that. And you don't dismiss what they say. You know, you've got to look at them carefully. And I've looked at some of these images, and I've read a book by Mark Carlotto, you may have heard of. He's an image processing specialist. He has a PhD in the subject, for goodness sake. And he's written a book called The Cydonia Controversy, which he was good enough to send me. And I've been very, very impressed by what he's written about. And I look at some of these things, and I think, well, we don't want an astrobiologist on the ground there. We want an astroarchaeologist. We want somebody who understands ancient buildings. Maybe there is evidence there. You know, and if there was a civilization 3.5 billion years ago, you would expect to find some sort of remains still there on Mars. I don't dismiss those sort of things at all. I think it's a perfectly reasonable scientific thread of evidence that leads you to that sort of speculation. I have no problem with that at all.
Is it possible that the Martians are us? That they came here somehow?
Well, you know, there's a good chance that life developed on Mars even before it did on Earth, because the conditions on Mars, going back 4 billion years to when the planet had just cooled, and we know there was water, a lot of water on Mars in those days. There were oceans on Mars. We know it was warmer. We know it had a denser atmosphere. It was actually a more benign place for life in those long ago ages than the Earth was. So if life appeared here on Earth, why didn't it also appear even earlier, perhaps, on Mars? And we also know a means that life can be conveyed from one world to another, and that is by meteorites. We've got chunks of Mars here on Earth. We've got 70 chunks of rock that we know came from Mars. Now, they could have carried bacteria from Mars, which could have then evolved on Earth, or going back to my original idea that maybe advanced Martians developed. Okay, how about this? How about if 3.5 billion years ago or thereabouts, there were actually intelligent Martians, and they looked ahead and they realized their planet was dying. It was going to get colder. It was going to get drier. Hey, we've got to get out of here.
Yeah,
you know?
They knew.
What are their options? They can go underground, which is very time-consuming. It's not too great to live under the surface. We could go to other stars. Well, okay, if they have the technology, you could do that. No reason why not. Or you look at this other nice planet that's nearby and say, well, okay, we'll hop over there, you know? So there's those three possibilities. So, yeah, we could be related to Martians. Yeah, absolutely.
If life evolved on planet Earth with the smallest organism, is it conceivable to assume that if that same small organism were on a different planet under similar circumstances, would life evolve almost the same way? Would we get the fishes and the mammals and the human beings?
Well, I don't think you would in detail. You know, there's just too many twists and turns in the tale of how things develop. And if you look at certain periods on Earth, you know, go back about 500 million years, which isn't too long. I mean, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. So go back 0.5 billion years. There's something called the Cambrian explosion, which is when all these new, it was like suddenly nature was experimenting with all these new kinds of life, most of which didn't make it. You know, they just weren't equipped for survival. It was like throwing, let's see what we can do now. You know, like an artist who just tries something out and say, oh, that's no good. You know, that's not going to work. But occasionally something does work and it survives. And you look among the fossils in this so-called Cambrian explosion, you see all the weirdest things, you know, creatures that have strange number of legs and antennae sprouting in all directions. And most of these things, you look later on, they've disappeared. They just didn't survive for very long. Now, in another rerun of the Earth or in another world, some of those things would have survived if conditions had been right. Now, you know, life adapts to whatever it finds around itself. So, you know, for example, on Mars, creatures that developed very early on, and I believe they're still there today, some of them, are going to adapt to whatever, you know, in the case of Mars, it got a lot colder, it got a lot drier. So what do you do? If you're going to be on the surface, you've got to be able to survive those sort of harsh conditions, or you'd bury yourself underground and survive there. If you're on Europa, which is one of the moons of Jupiter, and all you've got is this huge ocean beneath the surface, you've got to live in eternal darkness and somehow get your energy from the water or stuff that's coming up from the seabed or stuff that's filtering down through the rock from the surface. You've got to adapt in different ways. And who knows that even that life somewhere else is even based on carbon. Maybe it's based on silicon. Maybe it can be based on pure radiation. We don't know the limits of life. So our little example here is no indication of how diverse life could be elsewhere. At the same time, there could be constraining factors. You know, some people say, well, yeah, there are probably other humans somewhere else. Maybe it's good to have hands that can grasp things, maybe a pair of eyes that can give you binocular vision, and a single brain somewhere protected inside a bony skull. You don't want your brain hanging out somewhere where it can get bashed around by everything that you bump into. You need it protected. You know, you need somewhere to take air in. You need some form of locomotion. So there are basic things that are going to be the same, you know. Silicon-based fish might still have fins because that's a good way of moving through sure. a liquid. So, yeah, you've got these two different factors at work, things that, where nature experiments with different life forms and the basic laws of physics, which say, well, this is the best way of surviving.
What would a silicon-based human being look like on another planet?
Very, very difficult to say. I mean, you know, silicon is an element that is similar chemically to carbon in many ways. And, you know, carbon is the basis of all life that we know here on Earth.
Yeah.
But silicon, if you look at the way chemicals are arranged, it's very similar in the way it can form big molecules. Now, you know, does it mean because a life form is based on silicon that it has to be different in its appearance? We don't know. The sort of conditions you'd expect silicon to be good at would be more high temperature environments. So what sort of creatures would you get in a high temperature environment? It's hard to say. It's hard to speculate. You're almost getting into Star Trek territory there. You know, they talked about a few silicon based life forms in Star Trek, but it's getting into the realm where, you know, yeah, anything goes. Whatever you choose to speculate could happen out there. And what we need now is actual data that tells us what is going on.
In our solar system, when the planets all formed, did they all form at about the same time?
Well, we believe so. You know, within a few million years, this is I can only give you the scientist view on this Yeah, I mean, to begin with, the solar system consisted of a big cloud of gas and dust, and then the sun formed at the center of it, pulled in most of that matter and formed into a star. And then what you ended up with is a sort of pancake of gas and dust going around it, which then consolidated into the planets. And, you know, within a few million years, the idea is that they all formed more or less at the same time, yeah.
What keeps the rotation for all those objects, or even the dust when it was forming?
Well, whatever gravity and whatever rotation you start out with is what you end up with. There's no way of increasing it or decreasing the overall rotation rate. So it's kind of like, if you imagine, as far as spinning goes, imagine an ice skater, okay?
All right.
And to begin with, you know, she's got her arms stretched out, way out from her body, mm-hmm. and then as she pulls them in, she spins faster and faster and faster. You know, she's going faster, but her overall momentum stays the same, because if she puts her arms back out again, she'll slow back down to the rate she had to begin with.
Right.
And it's the same with the planets. You know, you start out with an interstellar cloud of gas and dust that is rotating very slowly just through random motion. And then as it pulls itself in through gravity, so it spins faster and faster. And it happens with individual planets as well. They pull in gas and dust, and they end up with a small rotation which gets faster as it pulls itself in. And then once it's got that rotation, it's going to keep it. There's nothing that's going to slow the Earth down. There's no friction, you know. So the Earth is going to keep on spinning more or less as it does now for the rest of time. There's no, unless some outside influence, like a collision, that changes the momentum,
right.
That it's going to stay the same.
What kept the particles together? How did they end up sticking together?
Okay, well, you know, again, you're talking about a question that is still open. But to begin with, what pulls them in is gravity. If you've got a bunch of particles that are spread out, the only force really, by which they can pull themselves in is gravity.
Okay.
Things like magnetism and electricity don't really come into it. Once they get close together, then you can start getting chemical bonding. So, for example, if you get two particles of, say, graphite, a form of carbon, once they get close together, they can and they almost touch, then you can get a chemical bond, and those two things will stick together by chemistry rather than gravity. And then gravity will bring in more particles, and they'll stick together by chemistry. So eventually, you get a whole ball of rock that is bound together more on the chemical level than it is by gravity. But it's gravity that starts the whole thing off, and then it's chemistry that takes over once it gets, you know, really closely bound together.
So it's possible when Earth was forming, David, it could have been a real small little dinky planet, and then it got bigger and bigger and bigger, almost
basically,
like a snowball.
Yeah, kind of. You know, it pulls itself in, and to begin with, all of the material would have been sort of the same kind of, you know, icy, rocky mixture, and then gradually the heavier stuff sinks towards the center again by gravity. That's why we have an iron core to the planet, an iron nickel core. Those are the heaviest elements on Earth, and then as you move out from that, the stuff gets lighter and lighter until you get to the crust, and then you've got the lightest rocks of all on the surface, and that's called differentiation. And you see that in all of the planets except the very smallest moons, where they don't have enough gravity to kind of settle out that way.
Who in the heck designed this?
You're getting back to that question again. Well, you know, there's different ideas in there. There's the if you like, the biblical idea that somebody is kind of you know, there's an overarching intelligence of God or something that sort of micromanages all this thing and says, you know, this is the way it's going to be, and I impose my will upon that. That's the way it's going to be. And then there's another sort of version of that that says there's an intelligence behind the universe that wrote the laws of physics and nature into the whole thing to begin with, so that's the way it would turn out. And then you've got kind of the modern scientific view, which is that there's a whole bunch of universes out there, and different things happen in different universes. Sometimes it happens like the way it does in our universe, and in other cases, who knows what happens.
David, when we come back at the top of the hour, we will really get into the book now, We Are Not Alone, as we talk about why we are not alone. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. What do you think jump-started this microbial life, David, throughout the universe?
You mean what do I think started life in general? What's the trigger, the origin of life? If I could answer that, I'd have a Nobel Prize, because that is one of the unanswered questions of science, is that is the origin of life. And, you know, there are various hand-waving arguments about how it happened. You know, you know how you can get the original basic chemicals, you know, the amino acids. You can get to that stage. Amino acids are building blocks of proteins. You kind of know how they build into proteins. But how you get from those type of, you know, promising molecules to something that's wrapped up in a cell and that you can call alive is an unknown. And I don't know. And no scientist on the planet, and no one on the planet, can tell you how that happened. We simply don't know. And there is a big jump, unfortunately. It's a big gap between these building blocks and something that you can say is a definite life form. It's a huge gap, unfortunately. And the life form has a whole lot of information wrapped up inside itself in its DNA, because it has to then make copies of itself so that, you know, it carries on to the next generation and so on. That is not an easy gap to bridge, and we're quite a way away from it at the moment. I have to be honest with you. Most scientists like to say, oh, we're going to answer that in time. Yeah, it's coming along, and maybe they will, but we don't know. I don't know.
Is it accurate to say that substances that were not alive, they were not alive, formed, and all of a sudden, that formation, they became alive?
It's... At some point, that must have happened. At some point, you've got to be able to put a label on something and say, that is now alive. Before, it was just a bunch of chemicals. Now it's alive. And I suppose it gets down to kind of having something that you can call a self, in a way, something that is able to exist independently of its environment. And to do that, there has to be something. It has to be in a bag of some kind, a membrane. It has to separate itself from whatever else is around itself. And that's kind of a big distinction. You know, how did that happen? How did the information get into that bag of chemicals that says, now make a copy of yourself, now reproduce and produce more of your kind so that you can carry on into the future? Yeah, at some point you have to be able to make that distinction. It probably happened fairly suddenly. Yeah.
Let's take out for a moment all the discussion of UFO visitations and the possibility and things like that. Let's just take that out of this equation for just a moment. What do you think will happen, or do you think we will ever find intelligent life like ours? And if we do, how do you think we'll find it?
Okay, well, the thing is, it depends.
I don't make it easy on you, do I?
You don't make it easy, no. And there's a big discussion going on in astrobiology at the moment about how difficult it is to move from simple life forms like bacteria, of which there are a whole abundance around. They're always the most common things, even now. You know, we always think, well, you always focus on advanced life, but in fact, they're still there, of course, and they're still there in huge numbers, and they are the most successful life forms on the planet. There is a huge discussion about how easy it is to get from that single-celled stage to, you know, the sort of things that are more interesting to us as humans, that is plants and animals and, of course, ourselves, and how often that happens elsewhere on other worlds. It's a big question, and that is where I tend to take the optimistic side of things because I see intelligence as being a driving force. I look at the way... It took a long time for advanced intelligence to come about on the Earth for one reason or another, but I suspect that it is that nature has a compulsion to try to reach intelligence. So I'm on the optimistic side of things, and you can tell that from the books I've written. I mean, going back to the previous book I wrote, it was called Life Everywhere. This one is called Why We've Already Found Extraterrestrial Life. I'm an optimist as far as astrobiology goes. I'm an optimist as far as I'm saying how often simple life becomes intelligent life. You can talk to other people and they'll say that doesn't happen very often, that maybe we're even alone in the universe. I don't believe that. I think intelligence is a driving force within nature, and I think wherever it's possible to come about, it will come about, and that we will find it out there among the stars. But it may be well beyond where we are, because we were talking before that we've only had flight for 100 years. Okay?
That's right.
So what about a civilization that is just 1,000 years ahead of where we are? They'll be doing undreamed of things. We can't even predict where we're going to be in 10 years' time, let alone 100 or 1,000 or 1,000,000 years' time. Most technological civilizations out there are going to be so far ahead of us, they're going to seem like gods by our standards, because we are new. We're new kids on the block as far as technology goes. So my answer to your question is, I think it's quite often that the jump to intelligence occurs quite frequently, wherever it's possible, and the most intelligent life out there is going to be way beyond where we are at the moment.
I should, but I don't know why I'm not excited about the possibilities if they find, microscopic life out there.
I know what you're saying. What you're saying. But, you know, you can either approach this problem from one of two directions. You can either go looking for the big game. In other words, you can be, you know, somebody who's excited by UFOs and by pyramids on Mars, and you can start from, or if you want to get more conventional, looking for radio signals from other planets.
Yeah.
And go for that big game and go for the all or nothing type of thing, you know? And it is an all or nothing, you know, because if you're listening for signals from other stars, as we have been for 40-odd years now, and we've not found anything, I don't find that very exciting. If we found it, of course, it would be so exciting that you'd fall off your chair, you know?
Yeah.
But at the other end of the game, which is kind of where I like to be, is a bottom-up guy, where you start looking for proof that there is life out there. And as we've claimed in our book, we already have that proof. I find that exciting, not because I find bacteria particularly exciting, but because if there's life out there, I believe there's all kinds of life out there. So to me, it's more exciting to get that proof that there's some kind of life than waiting forever based on, you know, kind of far-fetched speculation. You can go from two directions, and both are interesting. But I like to think that there is alien life out there of any kind, and then I can build on that. That's just my approach, you know?
What percent of scientists do you think believe that there's some kind of life, even if it might be microbes, that there's some kind of life out there?
Oh, I think it's well into the 99 percentile.
Wow.
Yeah, I think that's almost a universal assumption among scientists. And of course, you've got to say, well, scientists who know what they're talking about, because, you know, if you happen to be a mechanical engineer or a physicist, maybe your opinion isn't any better than the guy that lives next door, you know. But if you're talking to astrobiologists or biologists who've studied the problem, most of them today would say the chances of life out there is just so high that you know it's almost a certainty. There's a few. And they are led by almost philosophical beliefs who would say that life may be unique to Earth. That's a very minority view. Most say now that life is probably fairly common out there. The big question, going back to what we said before, is how often that simple life becomes advanced and intelligent. That's an unknown.
How about 50, 70 years ago? What would that percentage
be? Oh, if you'd been in this science 50 to 70 years ago, you would have been scoffed at. You wouldn't have been able to make a living at it. And certainly 70 years ago, if you pretended you were an astrobiologist or an exobiologist, as it was called in those days, you wouldn't have got anybody to listen to you. They would have said, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, it would have been like a ufologist is today. You know, but that kind of difference. You know, ufology today is at the margins of science, and you couldn't get a ufology paper presented in a mainstream, you know, conference. There's no way you would. But 50 years ago, the same situation would have applied to astrobiology. So it's changed. Astrobiology is now mainstream science. 50 years ago, it was almost at the margins of science.
Let's go back to Mars for a moment. Mm-hmm. What do you think is there in terms of life?
Well, can I talk about Viking for a moment?
Absolutely.
Because that's where it all starts. And as I said before, I believe that Viking found life, and I think that maybe not intentionally, but scientists painted the wrong picture of what happened. You know, the message was put out that Viking found nothing more than unusual active chemicals in the soil, that basically Mars was dead. And that's had a profound effect on everything that's followed, including the direction of the whole space program. So the question is, where did things go wrong? Well, back in 76, two identical spacecraft, Viking 1 and 2, landed on Mars. They both carried miniature biology labs, kind of about the size of a microwave oven. It was quite small. But they had three experiments which were looking directly for life on Mars. And they were the first spacecraft to do this. And incredibly, the only spacecraft that have ever looked for life on another planet. You know, in the 30-odd years since then, we've never sent out another probe to look for life. And that's because the mainstream science said Viking didn't find anything. So, you know, they carried out some experiments. I just want to zero in on a couple of them. One was called the label release experiment. One was called the pyrolytic release. And the agreement was beforehand, if any of these experiments found a positive signal, then we would say that they'd found life on Mars. And that was thrown out the window later on. So what the label release experiment did was it took a sample of Martian soil, it dripped some water onto it, some goodies, some nutrients, kind of like a chicken soup type of thing for bacteria. And the neat thing was that those nutrients were laced with radioactive carbon. And the hope was that any bugs in the soil would metabolize that food and they'd give off radioactive carbon dioxide, which you could then pick up with a radiation detector, a Geiger counter. And lo and behold, that's exactly what it found, a big rush of radioactive carbon dioxide, which lasted for about 3 days, exactly what you'd expect if there were bacteria in the soil. And not what you'd expect if there was a chemical reaction. It wouldn't last that long. There's no way. The other experiment, the pyrolytic release experiment, showed that organic chemicals were manufactured in the soil by something. That's kind of hard to explain without life going on. Mm-hmm. And these two together gave life signals. So why didn't scientists say that Viking had found life? Because according to the pre-agreed criteria before Viking ever left the launch pad, both of those experiments found life. The reason was there was another instrument on board Viking, which was called the GCMS, That stands for gas chromatograph mass spectrometer. And the whole purpose of that instrument was to look for organics, organic material, anything containing carbon, basically, in the Martian soil. And that came up negative. It didn't find a single thing. It didn't find a single carbon-containing molecule in the soil. And it was used as a court of appeal, basically. So you've got two experiments saying, yeah, there's life here by pre-agreed criteria. Another instrument says there can't be life, no organics, you can't have life. But that instrument wasn't working properly. And we know it wasn't working properly. It's been demonstrated. It was demonstrated even before Viking took off, although it wasn't really well-known or advertised. But in several studies since then, identical equipment to the GCMS been tested on Antarctic soils, on soils from deserts regions on Earth, which are similar to Mars, and it has failed to find life where we know there is life by other instruments. And so this Court of Appeal instrument was faulty. It couldn't, we know it couldn't have detected organic material on Mars, and yet that's the way it panned out, that scientists used that as a way to say there's no life on Mars. So the GCMS found nothing, and so what did the Viking scientists team do? They dismissed the positive readings of the other two experiments, and they said that the activity in the soil was due to some kind of reactive chemical like hydrogen peroxide, and that was that.
What kind of critters, David, do you think might be on Mars today?
Well, I think there's small life in the surface. And by the way, we've got some pictures on the Coast to Coast website that maybe people would like to check out.
Yes.
And I think the most interesting ones are the ones that come from the recent Phoenix lander, which was on Mars. It's obviously still on Mars, but it was working on Mars last year and sent back a lot of useful information. The most intriguing things, and there are three pictures that I've given to put on the Coast to Coast website that people can check out now if they want to, the microscopic images of the soil, and they show three objects which are labeled A, B, and C, and you can see quite distinctly that they've moved. Nothing in the surrounding material has moved, but these three objects, which are about the size of bacteria, have clearly moved in different directions. Now, it's not wind. Wind would tend to blow everything the same way, and they're moving in different directions. Apart from fluid motion, unless there's some fluid in there which we don't know about, those things have moved of their own volition, and they look like single-celled organisms. So maybe what we're looking at there is our first glimpse of living Martians. I think there's microbial life in the surface layer of soil, probably nothing more than that. Underground, there is probably a much bigger community of life, which could even include larger organisms up to the size of worms even, or possibly even larger than that. So I think we've got a thin layer of life on the surface or just below the surface, and then deeper down we've got a bigger community of Martians. I think anything much bigger than that may have lived a long time ago and have since died out or moved elsewhere. What there is there today, I think, is fairly simple stuff.
Insect life, possibly?
Well, I did mention worms, and if you look at, actually, if people want to go into this further, if you do a Google search on unidentified moving objects, Phoenix, say, in your search, you'll get to a YouTube video where a guy has actually looked at the raw images and has produced some very, very interesting time-lapse sequences of images that appear to show something more than microbial life. Now, yeah, so it is possible that deeper down there could be multicelled life up to and including insect or worm-like organisms. I wouldn't find that too surprising.
Let's assume for a moment that Mars might have been inhabited with the intelligent beings like ours, maybe even more intelligent than us, I hope so. And they built structures, they had pyramids, they had an evolution. What do you think happened to them, David? They're not there now.
No, it's obvious they're not there now, unless by some miracle they're living underground. But I think we would see some evidence of that in the atmosphere. There would be some traces of it. So one possibility is, of course, they died out, and we'll find their remains on the surface or under the surface, and that's a possibility. It seems to me that if they were building structures, if they were building something like pyramids, then they're at a similar stage in their evolution to where we are today, give or take a few thousand years, which is nothing really. And the decline of Mars from a vibrant living world, which had water and a thick atmosphere, to what we see today, which is a very inhospitable place by human standards, would have been slow. It would have taken place over millions of years. So any creature on the surface, you could imagine today, if we saw that the things, conditions on Earth were slowly changing, we'd do something about it. We're not just going to be sitting ducks waiting for it to happen. We'd build spacecraft. We would migrate somewhere else. So I would imagine if this is what had happened, it's a big if, but if it had happened, it's entirely possible that the Martians would have left their world and gone somewhere else. And we ought to find traces of that too. You know, if there was this kind of advanced technology, we ought to, in future, when we get there ourselves, be able to do the archaeology and uncover the history of what actually happened.
I believe if an astronaut goes to Mars and uncovers those kinds of relics, they would probably be in awe.
They would be absolutely flabbergasted, I should think. It would change everything. Whenever we discover traces of intelligence out there, whether it's past or present, it's going to change us forever.
David, let's leave Mars when we come back and talk about more life possibly in the solar system, and then let's go beyond. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with David Darling on Coast to Coast AM. David, beyond Mars, what do you think of Venus and the possibilities there?
Well, you know, Venus long ago was thought to be kind of like the Earth was in a primitive stage. And you could imagine all sorts of things because it's cloaked in a thick blanket of clouds. You can't really see the surface at all. Today, we know that Venus is a very hot place. The surface is hot enough to melt lead, even hot enough to melt zinc. So you're not going to really expect life on the surface of Venus today. But just as in the case of Mars, a long time ago, 3 billion-plus years ago, it could have been a much different story. There could have been vast oceans on Venus. There could have been life on Venus. Now, the question is, if there was, what's happened to it today? In the case of Mars, we think that if there's anything on the surface, yeah, that's fine, but some of it will have gone below the surface to escape the harsh conditions. On Venus, the opposite may have happened. It may actually have gone up into the atmosphere, and that's one of the topics we cover in our book. It's an unexpected discovery, really, and a kind of an unusual possibility that Venus might have life. We tend to discount it, but we do know that particles exist in the atmosphere of Venus, which are similar in size to bacteria. It's a dense atmosphere. They could be buoyed up there for weeks on end, multiplying. You could actually have an atmospheric life there about 30 miles above the surface in what's called the lower cloud deck. It's an intriguing possibility.
Well, that is one heck of a planet. Now, beyond, though, Mars, and we go out to the farther-reaching planets out there, their moons, David, seem more interesting than the planets themselves.
I know. And that, again, is a huge surprise because traditionally you think of anything beyond Mars as being almost a frozen wasteland. There's so little heat out there that, you know, you get out to Jupiter and the temperature at the surface of anything there is going to be about minus 150 Celsius. You know, that is just so cold. It makes Antarctica look tropical by comparison. You just can't imagine any life out there at all. And yet now we know that there are underground oceans, certainly on Europa, which is one of the moons of Jupiter, possibly on a couple of other big moons of Jupiter, Callisto and Ganymede, and going further afield to the Saturn, which is more than twice the distance of Jupiter. You've got moons there as well. Titan, the big moon of Saturn,
sure,
which could have an underground ocean and could even have life on its surface. It's got a dense atmosphere. It's the only moon in the solar system known to have a thick atmosphere. It's actually thicker even than the Earth's.
And methane lakes, right?
And methane lakes. So you've got hydrocarbon lakes on the surface. You've got a drizzle of hydrocarbon coming down from this thick atmosphere. You've got organics being produced high up by interaction with the radiation from Jupiter's radiation belts. You've got a lot of interesting stuff going on the surface, and we know even actually, surprisingly, of hydrocarbon lakes on Earth. There's one in Trinidad, for instance, mm-hmm. which supplied a lot of the asphalt on which New York was built, oddly enough. It's a very curious place. It's a sort of a big tarry pool. You can almost walk across it. It's so thick. And you would imagine there's not going to be anything alive in this thing, you know, this black syrupy asphalt. But sure enough, there are organisms living in there. We know it. In fact, my co-author on this book has actually experimented in this lake, and they've produced these extremophiles that are living in this hydrocarbon lake, very similar to what you find on Titan. So there is the possibility of life on the surface of Titan, living in these methane and ethane lakes, as well as underground on Titan as well. It's a very, very interesting place.
Are we going to explore these moons, David?
Well, yes, I think we are eventually. As you know, so much at the moment in the space program is up in the air, whether you're talking about NASA or the Europeans or other agencies. So much depends on the politics and on the budgets. But there are projects that are aimed at the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. And, you know, we're hoping within the next 10 or 15 years, sounds a long way off, but that maybe a probe will be sent out to explore the Jupiter system, especially focusing on Europa, hopefully would include a lander. There's some money going into that. It'll be a joint mission between the Europeans and the and NASA. But again, it's hard to set a timescale on these things. We are looking at least 10 years out before anything can get on the launch pad. But they're very high priority as far as astrobiologists are concerned. Certainly something that we ought to be doing, for goodness sake, you know. We spend money on all kinds of things. We can surely spend a little bit on looking for other life on nearby worlds. It seems to me it'll be a very interesting subject to explore.
Do you think SETI is wasting its time sending out the radio frequencies and trying to listen for radio frequencies?
Well, it's hard to say. It's like we said before, it's an all-or-nothing affair. If we get a message tomorrow, then everything they've done is justified. If they don't, then they're whistling in the wind, basically. I think it's a long shot. I've always thought it was a long shot. I think it's something we have to do because it's kind of like a possibility we have to be able to check off and eliminate. We really need to see if it will work. But what we're expecting is that there's something out there, some creatures out there, that are roughly at the same technological level as we are. In other words, using radio waves for communication. Well, that to me seems unlikely. It seems to me that 500 years from now, we're going to find some form of communication maybe based on quantum principles or on something else that works faster than the speed of light, that doesn't involve radio waves. So it's a long shot. I don't think it's a waste of time. I think it's just highly improbable that we're actually going to hear anything.
You know, when you look at the movie Independence Day,
yeah,
where, you know, we wake up in the morning and there are huge craft from unknown planets all over the place, you know, trying to take advantage of us poor Earthlings. Mm. Is that a real possibility, David? Can that happen one day?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me at all if we were being watched. You know, simply because we are reaching that stage ourselves. We can now detect nearly Earth-like planets. Over the next few years, we're going to be announcing the discovery of Earth-like planets. That's what the Kepler mission is designed to do. Once we have identified Earth-like planets, we will be able to analyze the atmosphere of those worlds and look for signs of life, which I'd be very surprised if we didn't find. We will be able to look for subtle signs of technological life, such as pollutants in the atmosphere. And, of course, if we can do that at our relatively primitive stage, then any beings out there within really thousands of light years of the Earth have been doing the same thing to us. They've been watching us.
Sure.
They've been watching the evolution of Earth. So as soon as life appeared here, as soon as we had for example, primitive plants that began to transform the atmosphere and pour oxygen into the atmosphere. That's an immediate sign of life. So going back even millions of years, any other intelligence that has been monitoring worlds as we are today, beginning to do today, would have highlighted the Earth as something of special interest, and they would have continued to monitor us over the ages till today. We are, you know, changing our planet. We're pumping gases into the atmosphere that are very indicative of a technological civilization. They'll know we're here. And what would we do if we found another planet, say, 100 light years away, that we saw obviously had intelligent life on it? We would make every effort to find out more about it. Now, what would we do? We'd focus our telescopes on it. We might even rush to send probes out there to develop the technology to send probes across interstellar distances to survey this planet. Now, I think that's probably what's happened with us. It wouldn't surprise me at all if there were probes now orbiting in orbits around the sun that were looking very closely at the Earth. The question is, are they in some sort of cloaked mode so that we can't detect them? Now, that seems to me very likely. If you've got a very advanced civilization and it wants to watch a more primitive one like ourselves, they're going to work like anthropologists do. They don't want to change that culture. They don't want to change that race. They'll have some kind of prime directive which says we'll watch, but we won't interfere unless there is some emergency and we feel it necessary to intervene. They're going to watch in a kind of an invisible mode, so we're not necessarily aware of their presence, but it seems to me highly likely that we are being surveyed from a distance and possibly also within the solar system as well.
What if back in the era of the 40s, when we let off the atomic bomb, would that have been a trigger for any extraterrestrial race to say, oh my, what's going on that planet?
For sure, yeah. And quite possibly because they went through the same phase themselves. It wouldn't surprise me if all civilizations go through crises like that, where they develop weapons of mass destruction, where they start to affect their environment to a dangerous level. And they're all critical points at which that civilization could end. You know, if the Cuban crisis had gone the wrong way, we might not be here today. You know,
that's
we might not be here in 100 years' time. We don't know that. Now, the question is, if somebody is watching us and they're a sort of benign intelligence and they're okay watching, but they don't want that race to die, then at some point they might intervene to say, hey, guys, this is the way you solve this problem. Or they might do it on a more subtle level by intervening without us really realizing it to change the direction of history. And it seems to me that could be a possibility as well, these kind of watchers in the galaxy that try to cultivate the development of young civilizations like ourselves. And they don't try to interact with us too much, but just when it's necessary to avoid self-destruction. I don't think they'd see us as a threat because we're so primitive. I mean, nuclear weapons to an alien race that's a million years ahead would be like pea shooters.
It's nothing.
They're not going to be afraid of us, but they may be afraid that we will self-destroy when we've got so much potential if we can get beyond that. So you could see intervention happening at some sort of level. Yeah, for sure.
Or maybe we, you know, through atomic weaponry, maybe we could tear space and time. I don't know. Maybe that would concern them.
Well, you certainly there's been that suggestion of experiments that are going on today. You know, the Large Hadron Collider, for example, has raised concerns that maybe it can
make a black hole,
or it could cause a rip in space-time, which could actually end the entire universe. You know, that we could slip into. They're at the edges of speculation, but even conventional physicists have come up with some ideas that would suggest that we're possibly altering the course of things. And yes, when you get to that level where you're recreating energies that haven't existed since the Big Bang, since the first trillionth of a second of the universe, then they've got their own self-interest at stake, and they wouldn't want any experiment that could endanger reality as a whole to happen. And then you would obviously get intervention, either on a subtle level or on a more, you know, you've got to change or else level.
And of course, there are theories that we've been seeded by some of these ETs also, David.
Well, that too is a possibility that we're actually the children of this sort of seeding, either very early on at a primitive level or later, without us realizing it. This is the panspermia hypothesis, or a sort of directed panspermia, where intelligence has actually seeded us here. And of course, if that was the case, then you would expect life to be more similar throughout the universe, because we would reflect whoever the seeding intelligence was. We would be somehow related to them in a way. I personally think that's a little far-fetched. I'm not sure I go along with that. I suspect that life did evolve within the solar system, either here or on Mars, rather than having come from elsewhere. It's certainly a possibility. You can see how it could have happened, but I'm not sure that's actually what did take place here.
Why do we have so many different life forms on this planet? How come we don't have just 5 or 10? I mean, we have zillions of them.
Yeah. It's almost like nature experiments in various ways. To begin with, maybe life forms would have been fairly similar, although you tend to always get predators and prey. So as soon as you get a life form, you'd get some other life form that used the other one as food. So then you have two, and then you have three, and then you have competition and diversity. I think it's a question of, as conditions change, life just adapts in all sorts of different ways to fill every available niche, if you like, in the environment. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But it's almost like, and this is why I think that life is common throughout the universe, because it seems to evolve and adapt to suit whatever conditions are available to it. It will fill every available niche, and I think that's what's going on. I think it's just that nature finding all this diversity of environments and just finding life forms that work within that environment.
I think so too. As you were putting together with your partner, We Are Not Alone, what fascinated you the most, David, about this?
For me, the realization that there is life close by. And personally for me, I don't know whether my co-author would go along with this, but the fact that once we have proof of that, and I believe we do have proof, it opens up the whole field to all sorts of life being out there, all kinds of intelligent life, and the possibility that we will communicate with it and learn so much in the future. Now, that may happen sooner than later, possibly within the next decade or two.
Possibly so.
That's what excites me about it. Yeah.
You know, the wonders of science abound. I mean, there's no question about it. Would you still go into astronomy today if you're in school?
I think I would. I mean, it's something that just captured me very early on. I mean, I think as far back as I can remember, certainly from the age of 5 or 6, my dad brought back this set of encyclopedias, and of course covered all areas of knowledge at the time, these black and white photos, and it was the astronomy section, the reconstructions of what it looked like on the moon. Of course, this was, you know, before we sent out probes to the planets, and before men landed on the moon. It was in the late 50s, really, 1960, late 50s, 60, right at the beginning of the space age. But it was just something that sparked me off. So I can't imagine. I think my brain is just set up that way. I'd probably lean more towards astrobiology than astronomy today, because it's life in the universe that excites me more than dead planets. So I think maybe I'd lean more towards the biology side of it. But I that's really what turns me on, you know.
You seem to include the God factor in some of your thoughts. I mean, that's what I picked up in when I was reading them.
Yeah. And I've written books. I mean, if anybody goes to my website, you'll find that I've written books other than astronomy. I've written books called Soul Search and Zen Physics, which are really more about who we are than if life is out there. They're about the nature of self and what happens to us after we die, and the nature of consciousness, which I think science has a very, very poor handle on. I think scientists just simply cannot come to grips with the nature of consciousness. They try to explain it in terms of just simple brain works, and I think there's more to it than that. And I think that there is something that survives beyond death. I believe that there is an overall consciousness. I think consciousness is a basic property of the universe, just like matter and energy are. This is not a conventional scientific view, I realize. It's a fundamental, heartfelt belief that I have, that there is a consciousness to everything. There's a consciousness imbued in everything, that a stone has a certain level of consciousness, that when we die, our self, our our individual consciousness opens out. It doesn't close. When the brain shuts down, it's like the brain acts like a filter, and when we die, that filter is removed, and we join with the consciousness of the universe. And if you want to call that God, I don't mind. That's just a label, you know.
I wish more scientists would think your way, David.
I hope they will. I think that over time they will come, because science, the old word science simply means knowledge. It just simply means the search for knowledge. Simply, you know, what is the nature of things and where do I fit into it? Science has become very compartmentalized and narrowed. I think scientists need to broaden out, look a little bit further afield.
All right. Well, you stay with us, because David Darling, our special guest tonight, will be with us for one more hour. And we will take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. We'll be right back. I may have the hot off the presses book, We Are Not Alone, David, huh?
I think you might do, yeah. Proof of extraterrestrial life. Can't get any hotter than that.
No, not at all. Amazon.com, I guess, they have it?
That's right. And as they say, all good bookshops. So, yeah.
You had fun doing this one, didn't you?
I really did. This is one of my funnest books. I thought, yeah, we're really putting ourselves on the line here. My co-author, myself, and I this was a blast. Nothing I like better than hunting aliens and then writing about it.
Well, you're good. And my buddy Seth Shostak here wrote a little bit for you in the book, too. And
he gave us a nice little write-up there, yeah.
As much as one wants to try to decide whether SETI's going in the right direction or not, he makes searching for extraterrestrial life fun, doesn't he?
He's the exact guy you need. I mean, you need a huge optimist to carry that program forward, and he's a fantastic spokesman for that whole program, and I wish him the best, yeah.
Absolutely. Let's go to the phones. We'll go to Strongville, Ohio first on the wild card line. Michael, take it away, Mike.
Good evening, George and David.
Hi.
Just a simple question. Is there any chance that consciousness is just a byproduct of vibration, the way that we think that gravity is just a byproduct of motion?
It depends what you mean by vibration, I guess. Vibration is a very common concept in physics. I happen to believe, personally, if you're asking me what consciousness is, that it is something different than the material brain. I mean, the conventional view of science is that consciousness is something created by the brain, okay? Whether you want to call that a vibration or not, I don't know. What I believe is that consciousness is already out there, that it's not something that is created by the brain, but it is something filtered by the brain. Now, what form that consciousness actually takes, whether it's something like a field in the form of a gravitational field, or whether it's a vibration, I don't know what the nature of consciousness is, whether it's physical or whether it's something different than matter and energy. I just simply think that it is out there rather than being something that is formed within ourselves. I hope that answers your question, because I don't know whether it's a vibration or not. I don't know what the ultimate nature of it is.
David, the multiverse theory seems to be more and more prevalent now than it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, very much so. That's absolutely true. It seems to have just sort of seeped into mainstream science. You talk about that 20 or 30 years ago, and people would have thought you were crazy, you know, or at least being uneconomical. I mean, how could you possibly have so many, many universes out there? It just seems like we've got the one. Now it's just absolute mainstream. It's almost a prediction of our mainstream theories that there are this almost infinitude of universes. So, yeah, it's not science fiction anymore. That is what scientists would – they'd be surprised if there wasn't a multiverse these days.
Isn't that mind-boggling? Even
it blows your mind. Yeah, it's like the universe keeps getting – not the universe, but reality keeps getting bigger and bigger. I mean, to begin with, people thought there was just the Earth and these little things going around it, and all of a sudden the Earth's going around the sun, and all of a sudden the sun is just one of many stars. Then the galaxy is one of many galaxies. Now we're a universe among many universes. Just wonder where the whole thing ends.
We'll go to New York next. Julio, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
It was a few years ago, for some reason, I really got interested in the moon Europa.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I believe it was about a year ago, maybe two, on the NASA site, they had some diagrams and pictures showing different probes going to the moon, showing different ways of accessing the ocean different ways. Is that still in a process, something that they're working on doing?
I think most of those missions that you saw outlined then, and some of them were landers and some of them were orbiters, most of those were wishful thinking and have now kind of gone out of the window. And what they're talking about at the moment is a combined NASA European mission, which would take in, and I'm trying to remember the name of it, I think it's called the Europa Jupiter System Mission, which is a real mouthful, but it's competing it's competing with another outer solar system mission, which is called the Titan-Saturn System Mission. So that's directed more at the moons of Saturn than the moons of Jupiter. But at the moment, it's the Europa-Jupiter System Mission, which is kind of a multi-probe mission, which I think would include a lander probe on Europa, which we really need to do. We really need to get something down the surface to sample the substances that are actually on the surface of Europa. That is the only mission at the moment that I know has funding, at least for the planning stages, and that is likely to carry on into the future. But you know, I don't know what the launch date for that is, but it would.
It's 2020.
2020. Okay.
2020. David.
All right. Well, so we're 10 years in the future. So that's the only one that's on the drawing board at the moment. All those are the ones you saw a few years ago. Some of those concepts may have been wrapped up into this new one, but most of those have kind of died the death over through various funding issues.
My God, David, 2020 seems so long ago. Time ago.
Now, I know. It's a long time to wait, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh. Now it seems – but it's going to come up faster than you know it.
Well, yeah, that's the way it goes. I mean, I can't believe it's 3.5 years since I was on the show last, you know. I just think this is all – life's going past so quickly.
And we continue to get more and more responses for you. It was just like you were just on.
I know. Isn't that weird, scary?
It is. You know, I happen to believe, by the way, in the abiotic oil theory. And that is that this planet makes its own oil just the way it was formed. I don't believe in fossil fuels and plankton have created all this oil.
Okay.
By looking at Titan and its methane lakes and the hydrocarbon out there, does that back up that abiotic theory here?
You know what, George? I don't like to talk about things I don't know too much about.
Okay.
I guess it means that it is easy to create hydrocarbons in a natural environment. I mean, yes, those hydrocarbon lakes on Titan are not produced by life, that's for sure. They are drizzling out of the atmosphere. Whether there's life in those lakes or not is another matter, but they are being created naturally. So that's the best answer I can give you on that one.
They're not dead dinosaurs up there on Titan.
Exactly. No. I doubt it.
Let's go now to Dale, Columbus, Ohio, first-time caller. Hi, Dale.
Hi, George. Hi, David.
Hi.
It's a great topic tonight.
Thank you.
Hey, my first question was, if we're going to these other worlds and other planets, would we be considered the grays or the humanoids or the reptilians?
Well, that's a good question. I guess it depends how you define those things. I mean, I suppose we would class ourselves as humanoids, wouldn't we?
I don't know, because our the devices that these beings might see, if they are there, would be gray and silver and aluminum and.
Oh, you mean our technology? They'd look at our
right. Well, the same thing that's happening to us now.
Okay. Well, that's entirely possible. I guess it depends where you went. I mean, if you went to another star system, you know, because probably there isn't life, you know, intelligent life elsewhere in the solar system, indigenous life. In other words, we're not likely to go to Mars or Europa or bump into intelligent beings. But if we went to another star system and we found intelligent life out there, I guess it depends. It depends how common these things are. First of all, it depends whether you believe in grays and these other things or not. That's still speculative, isn't it? That's on the margins. That's way beyond the margins of science, really. So how would they classify us? I don't know. I think they would look at us, and if there are humans out there, they would probably classify us as humanoids. Although if they saw us in our spacesuits, maybe they would take that for being our exoskeleton or something. I don't know the answer to that. I would class us as humanoid.
And my second question was, don't you believe that the human mind is set or wired to believe that what we see is real.
Explain.
Well, people see ghosts. People see aliens. People see spaceships. Is that something that's pre-programmed into us, or is that something that we simply manifest through the media and books?
Well, you know, I don't think it's pre-wired because I haven't seen any of those things. I have to be honest with you. I've seen lights in the sky occasionally that I can't explain, but I don't jump immediately to the you know, supposition that they're alien spacecraft. That would be the last thing. That doesn't mean I don't believe in those things. It just means that as a scientist, I always look for a mundane explanation first and then eliminate that before I go on to, you know, wilder theories. I've never seen a ghost. So if it was pre-wired into the brain, then presumably everybody would be seeing these things and more or less all the time, and that doesn't happen. So I think that if these things are real, then they are part of external reality rather than being something that is, formed within the brain. Although, of course, people do hallucinate as well, but that's a different thing than what you're talking about.
Okay, next up we'll go to Joan in San Diego, west of the Rockies. I was just there. Hi, Joan.
Oh, that's right. You were. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
I could talk to you hours on what I need to do, but I'm going to try to make it as quick as possible. I had a near-death experience about 10 years ago, and all these strange things. Oh, and as I was coming out from being under, something whispered in my right ear, "You have to go back and heal families." And I just died, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to heal families. By the way, my father was a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at home with all this. I started this automatic writing. I came up with a way for children to read that is totally unbelievable. Now, remember, well, let me just say, I found that I was a walk-in. I watched sightings, and Ruth Montgomery was on. And I said, wait a minute, that sounds like me. So I started doing more research about walk-ins, and then automatic writing began. I brought my work to Barnes & Noble, How to Read, A Different Way for Children to Read, and the place. That's a half-hour story right there. But the
let's get a question out of
here. They went ballistic, and I've written also a screenplay with 22 songs, and it's animated, so I've got 34 products. And then I heard a lot about Palladians, and about a week ago somebody said that there may be two more planets, but in the solar system.
Now, let me ask you that, David. There has been talk of other planets in the solar system that we just haven't found them yet. What do you think?
Well, we know there are undiscovered objects in the solar system. We're finding things further out from the sun than Pluto all the time. We're finding objects that are as big or bigger than the largest asteroids in the solar system. It's entirely possible that there are undiscovered worlds out there that are, they could be even as big as the Earth. There could be objects out there. They'd be quite distant. They would be not obvious, obviously, because they haven't been discovered yet. But there are many worlds waiting to be discovered out there in what's called the Kuiper Belt and the Oort cloud that we don't know about. There could be millions of these objects, not just one or two. But if you're talking about planets of a substantial size, yes, there's the possibility. There's no scientific evidence for them whatsoever at the moment. The sort of things you hear about tend to be more on a level of it's predicted by such and such an ancient calendar or whatever. You know, it's more sort of subtle knowledge than scientific knowledge. There's nothing on the scientific horizon that says there's big planets out there, but there's nothing that says there can't be.
The work of Zachariah Sitchin, of course, talks about his interpretation of Sumerian texts, of which there's another planet in the solar system that is on a 3,600-year elliptical orbit, comes close by the planet every 3,600 years, and he talks about how perhaps visitors from that planet came here to genetically alter us because they were trying to mine for gold or something to sprinkle it in their atmosphere for some reason. But he also talked about how these tablets talked about how in the early stages of the solar system, a planet collided with Earth. And it is uncanny because I think science talks about collisions like that, don't they?
Well, we know that something collided with the Earth because that's how the moon was formed.
Chipped us off, right?
Yeah, it chipped us off. It's something about the size of Mars collided with us. But that's a long time ago. We're talking 4 billion years ago. That's before we think there was life on the Earth.
Right.
That's not within sort of history or even prehistory. This is going back, you know, to the early days of the solar system. Yes, collisions happen all the time. Asteroids smash into us. That's what killed off the dinosaurs. We know that other worlds have been hit. They happen not regularly nowadays, but they do still happen. But I don't know much about Sitchin's work, to be quite honest. I have to be frank with you about some of these things, George. I'm not a knowledgeable. That doesn't mean I dismiss it. I mean, I can't dismiss something I don't know anything about. But I do know that if a planet moved through the solar system, it would cause gravitational disturbances, which you would expect to see. And you would expect the planets to be disturbed by a passage of another planet through it. That's not exactly what we see. So I would question the veracity of that, but leave it as an open question, I guess.
What happened to this planet that may have collided with us? Where did it go?
We don't know. We don't know. I mean, maybe it got blown to pieces. Maybe it's one of the objects that are circling further out in the solar system today. Maybe it passed entirely into the outer parts of the solar system. There's simply no answer to that at the moment.
And the asteroid belt, a planet that blew up or just a planet that never formed?
Probably a planet that never formed, actually, because of the gravitational influence of Jupiter, which is very powerful. It didn't allow a planet to consolidate in that orbit. So, yeah, it's probably not a planet that blew apart. It's one that never actually formed.
Let's get a question from John in Chicago. Go ahead, John. You're up with us.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Good, John.
Hey, good.
Yeah, how you doing, fellas? Okay, I got two questions to ask. Okay, if the Viking probes on Mars, are these still working? And one day, if man should go to Mars, would he bring them back?
No, they're not still working. They worked for a couple of years, so their activity ceased in the late 1970s, so they've been inactive for about 30 years. They'd make a great museum piece, wouldn't they?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. They're not going to be brought back right away because that's a heavy load to bring back. They're going to be more interested in bringing rocks back to begin with to see if there's life in those rocks. But in the future, I would be inclined to think that maybe they'd bring one of them back to put it in the National Aerospace Museum and they'd leave one there in situ. That's what I would tend to do because there's two of them identical. So I'd bring one back, put it in the museum for everybody to see, and I'd leave the other one in a plastic bubble as a permanent memento on Mars.
You know, if life ended on this planet, and maybe a million years from now, these outer planets are visited by beings who came into our solar system, they would see, for example, the moon landers, they would see the Viking probes, they would see Spirit and Opportunity on Mars, and probably wonder, my gosh, where did they come from?
Exactly. Exactly. They would, and it wouldn't be immediately obvious. I suppose eventually when they started doing archaeological digging on the Earth, they'd realize that there'd been a civilization here, and they'd probably trace it to the place of origin. But it would be an interesting story to try to reconstruct a million years from now what had actually been going on.
David, we'll come back and take final phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Greg Hunter joins us from USAWatchdog.com as we talk about the healthcare plan and what it means to you. Interesting story in from webmaster Lex. I'll read a little bit of it. Neptune may have polished off a super-sized Earth that once roamed the outer solar system and stolen its moon to boot. The brutal deed could explain mysterious heat radiating from the icy planet and the odd orbit of its moon Triton. And there's also now a theory that perhaps Neptune was formed closer in and then made its way out. Fascinating. We'll be back with final calls with astronomer David Darling and astrobiologist David Darling on Coast to Coast AM. What do you think about contact anytime soon, David?
I think it could happen anytime. You know, and again, it gets back to, are we being watched, and do the creatures who are watching us feel the need to warn us or give us some information that would be beneficial to us in the near future. I think that could be a trigger for contact. So I wouldn't be surprised if we make contact tomorrow or in the next 100 years. It's kind of unpredictable.
Should we tell them where we are?
I think we've already told them. I think just by our activities on Earth, we've already told them whether we send out messages or not. They know we're here.
Okay, let's go back to the calls. Jonathan in Houston, you're up with David Darling. Jonathan, go for it.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
Good. Okay, John.
I had a question. What do you think is the reason for the technological jump just within the past 100 years? As far as throughout the history of humanity.
And it is so far. It is dramatic, David.
Yeah.
Because great-grandmother was born in 1898. She died in 2001. And just what she saw in her life was more than, the entire history.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it's accelerating, too. If you look at what's happening today with computers, personal computers, the Internet, nobody can predict, from year to year what's going to happen next. So the rate of progress is actually accelerating as time goes on. We had the Industrial Revolution, and then we had automation. We had a mechanical device, steam engine, leading to the internal combustion engine and so forth. And then we got the chip in the integrated circuit in the 50s or 60s, and things have just been accelerating. Whether there's something unusual happening there, or that's just the way technology normally develops in a sort of accelerated mode, I don't know. I think it may be as a normal progression once you get beyond a certain threshold, things tend to move faster and faster, and we may be caught up in that sort of exponential growth at present.
David, his grandmother lived to 103, and she lived through three centuries.
Isn't that wild? How many people could claim that? That is just extraordinary, isn't
three,
it?
It makes her sound like she was 300. She was 103.
Exactly.
But she made it.
Exactly. Just to say that you lived in the 19th century, what an incredible thing.
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. Let's go to Grace in Tucson, Arizona. You're up with us. Hi, Grace.
Thank you. You're an astrophysicist and an astrobiologist. Is that correct?
Well, my training was in astronomy. I did my PhD in to do with stars and how stars evolved. And as a writer, which I've been for most of my professional life, I have written extensively about life in space. So I suppose you could call me an astrobiologist, yeah.
So you are interested in life. So I'm sure you've had just the normal human curiosity in you. Every once in a while, you've checked out the fringes of your science. And, the buzz everybody's talking about if there's civilizations out there, how they are getting here. I don't think that they are traveling here. I think they teleport themselves. I really think they rearrange their molecules, and maybe when they get here, they have it all by design so that they'll have a vehicle when they get here. Mm-hmm. They rearrange their molecules. It's just teleportation. Mm-hmm. I don't think it has to do with anything with traveling for years and years.
Yeah.
But you mentioned something about civilizations possibly watching us and maybe not even intervening unless we're in dire crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But we're in dire crisis now.
Mm-hmm.
We have diseases we haven't been able to find the key to conquer. Mm-hmm. We have third world countries dying of starvation and contaminated water.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't see any kind of civilization out there that actually travels here. And people have actually had contact with them. I can't see the perverse pleasure of any civilization out there not stepping in and doing something to help us. I'm sure they have the methods to treat these diseases, which for them are probably so fundamental and basic. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, we're also engaged in wars, which are needless wars, and we're killing each other. I think that's crisis. I don't understand why a civilization would come out here and actually sometimes abduct our people. And Coast to Coast has had a lot of interviews with scientists who talk about abductions and about finding pieces of metal in people's bodies. I mean, all you have to do is mention the person, Linda Moulton Howe, and there's a whole cavalcade of information about animals being
She's
dissected.
She's on Thursday.
Yeah.
Well, let's get this take. David, first of all, you know, all these horrible diseases could be a way of this planet, and I believe in the Gaia theory, where I think Earth is a living organism by itself. This planet could be culling itself out. I mean, that may be a way it reduces population in its own way.
Well, I believe in the overall Gaia hypothesis as well. I think to get to the caller's point about whether a civilization that was watching us and could intervene and could do something about it, why don't they? There could be several reasons for that. There could be, I get back to, I know it's a very simple-minded way of looking at it, but a kind of prime directive where you don't actually get involved. You remember in all those Star Trek episodes, things would happen and there'd be all this controversy about should we intervene and do something? No, you've got to let this race develop on its own. They learn from their mistakes. If you are constantly intervening, it's like you're constantly correcting a child who, you know, should learn from getting things wrong because that makes them stronger in the end.
Yep.
The question is, how severe does the catastrophe have to be before you step in and say, hey, look, if you carry along this path, you're actually going to destroy your entire civilization, or how long do you let it carry on as a sort of a learning experience? And, you know, who knows? We're building speculation on speculation here. We're assuming, first of all, that we are being watched. I think there's every possibility we are. And then why don't they intervene? Well, if you believe in God, why doesn't God intervene? You know, the same question arises there as well. So I would suspect that it's a question of judgment. If somebody's watching us, they say, well, are they going to blow themselves up this minute? Are they on a terminal decline with their environment where unless we intervene now, they will be extinct within 100 years? Or is this a crisis we let run? And from that, they will emerge from it stronger at the other end. That's the only possible answer I can give to you on that one.
There you go, Grace. Next up, we go to Vincent in Anchorage, Alaska, west of the Rockies. Hey, Vince.
Hi. Let's see. I just wanted to ask you just about how far out would you say possible, possible fossil excavations on Mars would be? Would that be like within the 20-year range, you know, if we're going to be possibly getting up there in 15 years?
Well, to do looking for fossils, I mean, unless they're exposed on the surface and you could see them through the cameras of roving vehicles, that means you're talking about a manned exploration. And there is nothing at the moment that you could predict about that. I mean, the whole of the certainly the American space program has been turned on its head in the last few months. There was no obvious way that they were going to get to Mars quickly anyway with the budget that NASA had, even with the best will in the world. Now with the focus being placed more on private space, manned space flight, and NASA focusing on breakthrough missions, maybe robotic missions, there's no way of saying. It looks like, to me, we're looking at a manned mission to Mars now at least 25 years in the future, and you would need a crew out there to actually look for fossils. So it's depressing to think about, but yeah, I think you're looking at least 2035 now for a manned mission to Mars.
I've noticed some strange things from the Spirit and the Opportunity when they took some pictures of nearby things on that, on Mars. Very weird.
Well, you know, and there's, yeah, I've seen some of these pictures too. I've seen pictures of, you know, fossils and you know, little what looked like, you know, you could imagine them to be all sorts of things. The question is, what actually are they? You know, and if you saw them from a different direction, would they still look suspicious? Would they still look like a figure sat on a rock, or would they still look like a skull? Among all the, you know, many, many millions of rocks that those rovers have looked at, most of them look like rocks. Yeah, they just look like boulders or, you know, just odd-shaped rocks. Some of them occasionally look like something interesting. The question is whether they are or not, and you've got to be very careful about that. Just because something looks like something doesn't mean it actually is. And I'd mark them off as points of interest, but I'd need to be persuaded that they are really artificial or evidence of advanced life.
Next up, we go to Alberta, Canada. Charlie on the international line. Hi, Charlie. How are you?
Hey, George. Hey, David.
Hi.
I'm doing all right. All right. I have a two-part question. One was about gravity, and my question is if the planet Earth is spinning around the sun, which is several million miles away.
Yep.
And the sun is spiraling around a supermassive black hole in the center of the galaxy, which is probably quadrillions of miles away.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that imply that gravity can work from an infinite distance?
Yeah, it can. That is accepted that gravity acts over the entire distance of the universe. So your body, for example, although it is small in comparison to a planet or a star or a galaxy, actually exerts a gravitational influence on the most distant object in the universe. So that is certainly true, yeah.
And the second question was about the structure of the solar system itself. I've never really seen any good diagrams of what exactly the asteroid belt is like.
Mm-hmm.
So is it literally like a gigantic sphere of asteroids encircling the sun in
the asteroid belt that is between Mars and Jupiter is a belt. It's not a. It's more like a donut or a frisbee, I guess. Well, a frisbee with a hollow in the middle, if you can imagine that. You know what I'm saying? It's not a whole sphere. It is actually a disc. When you get further out beyond Pluto, there are other regions of asteroids and comets that are spherical or more nearly spherical. But the main asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter is a belt, so it's flat. It's not. It doesn't go all the way around the sun.
Okay, we go to Midland, Michigan now. Mike's up with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good.
Yeah, I agree with one of your earlier callers. I mean, why would the aliens, stop and help us, They've been observing for so long. They just continue observing us, destroy ourselves.
Yeah,
I had a question about Mars, really. That was just kind of a comment. Have you ever really looked into, the Cydonia region and the face on Mars, the Deanian Pyramid, and other anomalies? Have you really looked into the angles and stuff?
I'm not an expert. I have looked at some of the work of Mark Carlotto. He wrote a book called The Cydonia Controversy, which is the most in-depth look that I've seen of those of the belief that they are artifacts. I find it reasonably persuasive, what he's written. And I think it needs further investigation. There's certainly some very strange shapes there and alignments which have attracted my interest. The face, of course, is interesting, although closer observation makes it look a little bit less face-like. But you've got those pyramid shapes nearby as well and some interesting alignments. I'm not an expert by any means. I haven't spent months poring over those pictures and measuring them and checking that what I'm reading is correct. But I find that what Carlotta has written is quite persuasive, and I think it would certainly be a place that I'd want to send a future probe or a manned expedition, just to see what it was like on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple more calls to go, David, and that'll be it. We're out of time here. Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Richard, you're up with David Darling.
How you doing? My question was for today. You were talking a little about the predator and the prey and how most creation, everything revolves around that.
Uh-huh.
And I was thinking about how human beings on the natural ecosystem, we really don't have anything that hunts us on a daily basis and evens out the numbers of, what's alive and what's not. So do you feel that maybe, the Zachariah Sitchin theory might be true, in the sense that maybe we was altered from primates, something came in, altered a primate to give us the features we have now, and therefore maybe that the way we live, we're altering the gases in the universe, which might allow an atmosphere for another species to live in?
Well, I don't know about the second part of your question with the link-up with the Sitchin theory. What I would say is that we would definitely be prey if we didn't have our technology to protect us. You go swimming in shark-infested water, and you'll very quickly find yourself prey. Or if you're out on the savannah without any protection, you will very quickly find yourself prey. We're certainly not very good at defending ourselves. We're not particularly strong for our size. We're not fast. We're sitting ducks, basically. We're out in the wild. It's only our civilization and our technology that's allowed us to multiply and to go virtually. We're predators on ourselves, if anything. But certainly in our natural condition, we would be
we would be prey to many species. I don't know about the link up with the Sitchin thing. I really
well, that's what I meant. As far as you know, okay, with our technology, we're able to defend ourselves within our own space. But maybe okay versus something else with better technology, we couldn't. But in the sense that okay, all natural creation has instincts that they survive off of, as to where a human has to be brought with its parents for X amount of years, and we have the brain to actually, you know, develop these technologies to comprehend reality on a different perception as to where other creation can't do that.
I agree with you there. We are on a different level, intellectual level, and you know, our brains set us apart from all other species. My personal belief is that has happened naturally, and I believe that the fossil record backs that up. I'm kind of conventional in that view, I guess, about how humans have evolved. We've evolved very, very quickly in the last couple of million years, but I sense that that is a natural evolution. That would be my answer to that, I guess.
David, it is incredible the way science continues technologically to bring us closer and closer to some of these answers.
Mm.
Maybe it's just a matter of time now.
Well, I think it is. I think conventional science doesn't have the answer to everything. I mean, maybe the ultimate questions, particularly the nature of consciousness and the meaning behind the universe, is maybe something that science is blind to. But I think in terms of, you know, other life out there, and the question of maybe how the universe came about in the first place, those could be answered within our lifetime, possibly.
Okay, next up we go to Jeremy, west of the Rockies. Real quick question, Jeremy, go ahead.
Okay, great show tonight, guys. There was a show on TV about the Mayan complex had a geometry that mimicked one of the star systems, and then on Mars there was another complex or hills or something that mimicked the one of the star systems. I was wondering what you thought about that.
I don't know anything about it, first of all. I can't be specific. It wouldn't surprise me if ancient civilizations did have knowledge that they acquired themselves or through contact. It wouldn't be surprising if we found archaeological remains on Mars that did the same thing. I would just have to leave it as an interesting point for now. I don't know specifically what you're talking about there. I didn't actually see the show. But those are certainly they would fit in with conventional science, I think. I'm quite happy to believe that those are possibilities.
Absolutely. David, familiar with the work of Richard Hoagland and his work on Mars?
Oh, yes, that's right. Richard's a great guy, a very imaginative guy, and he's come up with some interesting possibilities, yeah.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much again, David, and let's not let 3 or 4 years go by next time.
Great
huh?
pleasure, George. Thanks a lot.
All right, that's David Darling. We are not alone. Why we have already found extraterrestrial life.